Kaj? Zakaj? Kako? Zmeneta teroristična. Še vi črnava blasfemična. Mi spanec kratite, zvonov milozvočje dušite.
Lep dober večer in dobrodošli v nocojšnjih plunkih pozabe. Kar nekoliko obšla je rožnodolsko frekvenco vest o smrti pronicljivega pisca, prodornega kolumnista ameriškega Vanity Faira in drugih tiskovin, načelnega in zaželjenega govorca, ter seveda nadvse nenadjebljivega debaterja. Nasproti so mu stali Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Henry Kissinger in mnogi drugi težkokategorniki. Christopher Eric Hitchens je bil polemični družbeni kritik ter eden svetovnih protagonistov ateizma, skepticizma in zagovornik znanstvene misli. Napisal je 17 knjig, med bolj poznanimi izpostavljamo The Trial of Henry Kissinger, God is not great, How religion poisons everything in ne nazadnje Hitch 22. V 60-ih letih prejšnjega stoletja so ga na političnih shodih pogosto aretirali. Iz laboristične politične stranke so ga vrgli, ker je nasprotoval v vojni v Vietnamu. Postal je dopisnik za revijo International Socialism. Poznaje se je od levice oddaljil in se posvečal stran potem religije in totalitarizma. Med njima je seveda vztrajno risal enačaj. Po 11. septembru se je prerekal z Noamom Chomskim in drugimi protagonisti zadnjega protivojnega vala, ki so seveda namigovali ali trdili, da je za tragedijo delno odgovorna ameriška zunanja politika, delno ali v celoti. Obiskal je vse države na osi zla, podpiral je vojno v Iraku in takratnega predsednika Združenih držav, Georgea Busha mlajšega, in pri tem ustrajal do konca. Sredi decembra je po pljučnici v 62. letu starosti izgubil boj z rakom na požiralniku. Zato v nocojšnjih plunkih se priklanjamo spominu na velikana novodobnega razmisleka in edinstvenemu razlagalcu časa. Časa, v katerem vse manj ljudi razume, vse manj stvari. Ta poklon je pa seveda mogoč in najprimernejši v eni sami obliki, tako da človeku damo besedo, Christopher Hitchens.
It's true that publishers sometimes want to put a catchy or suggestive or challenging title, subtitle on a book. And so when we hit upon, or rather they hit upon, well, how religion poisons and why religion poisons everything, I knew what would happen. People would come up to me, they say, you mean absolutely everything? You mean the whole thing? They would take me literally. I thought, well, all right. One of the things you have to do in life as an author is live up to your damn subtitle. So I thought today I'd defend the subtitle. Because I think the title probably, when it came to me in the shower, I realized pretty much does speak for itself. Unlike that sign outside Little Rock Airport, huge yellow and black sign that you see from the airport that says, just Jesus. A word I have used myself, and a name I know, but put like that seems to say both too much and too little. You know what I mean? Well, here's how religion has this effect, in my opinion. It is derived from the childhood of our species, from the bawling, fearful period of infancy. It comes from the time when we did not know that we lived on an orb. We thought we lived on a disc. And we did not know that we went round the sun, or that the sky was not a dome, when we didn't know that there was a germ theory to explain disease and innumerable theories for it, the explanation of things like famine. It comes from a time when we had no good answers, but because we are pattern-seeking animals, a good thing about us, and because we will prefer even a conspiracy theory or a junk theory to no theory at all, a bad thing about us, this is and was our first attempt at philosophy, just as in some ways it was our first attempt at science. And it was all founded on, and remains founded on, a complete misapprehension about the origins, first, of the universe, and second, about human nature. We now know a great deal about the origins of the universe and a great deal about our own nature. I've just had my DNA sequenced by National Geographic. You should all, by the way, get this done. It's incredibly important to find out how racism and creationism have been abolished by this extraordinary scientific breakthrough, how you can find out your kinship with all your fellow creatures originating in Africa, but also your kinship with other forms of life, including not just animal, but plant. And you get an idea of how you are part of nature and how that's wonderful enough. And we know from Stephen Hawking and from many others, Stephen Weinberg and many other great physicists, an enormous amount now about what Professor Weinberg's brilliant book calls the first 3 minutes, the concept of the Big Bang. And we can be as sure as we could probably need be that neither this enormous explosion that set the universe in motion, which is still moving away from us at a great rate, nor this amazingly complex billion-year period of evolution, we can be pretty certain it was not designed so that you and I could be meeting in this room. We are not the objects of either of these plans. These plans don't know we're here. Sorry to say, wouldn't know or care if we stopped being here. We have to face this alone with the equipment, intellectual and moral, that we've been given, or that we've acquired, or that is innate to us. And here's another way in which religion poisons matters. It begins by saying, well, why don't we lie to ourselves instead? Why don't we pretend that we're not going to die, or that an exception can be made at least in our own case if we make the right propitiations or the right moves? Why do we not pretend that the things like modern diseases, which we can sequence now, sequence the genes of, like AIDS, are the punishment for wickedness and fornication? Why don't we keep fooling ourselves that there is a divine superintendent of all this, because it would abolish the feeling of loneliness and possibly even of irrelevance that we might otherwise have? In other words, why don't we surrender to wish thinking? That poisons everything, in my opinion, right away. It attacks the very basic integrity that we need to conduct the scrupulous inquiries, investigations, experiments, interrogations of evidence that we need to survive and to prosper and to grow. And it's no coincidence, no accident, that almost every scientific advance has been made in the teeth of religious opposition of one form or another that says we shouldn't be tampering with God's design. I suppose the most recent and most dangerous one of these is the attempt to limit stem cell research. But everyone could probably think of other forms of scientific research and inquiry, especially medical, that had led to religious persecution in reprisal. Thirdly, it's an attack, I think, on what's also very important to us, our innate morality. If there's one point that I get made more than another to me when I go and debate religious people, it's this. They say, where would your morals come from if there was no God? It's a question that's posed in Dostoevsky's wonderful novel, The Brothers Karamazov. One of the brothers says, it's Smerdyakov, actually, the wicked one, says it. If God is dead, isn't everything permitted? Isn't everything permissible? Where would our ethics be if there was no superintending deity? This, again, seems to me a very profound insult to us in our very deepest nature and character. It is not the case, I submit to you, that we do not set about butchering and raping and thieving from each other right now, only because we're afraid of a divine punishment or because we're looking for a divine reward. It's an extraordinarily base and insulting thing to say to people. On my mother's side, some of my ancestry is Jewish. I don't happen to believe the story of Moses in Egypt or the exile or the wandering in the Sinai. And in fact, now even Israeli archaeology has shown that there isn't a word of truth to that story or really any of the others. But take it to be true. Am I expected to believe that my mother's ancestors got all the way to Mount Sinai, quite a trek, under the impression until they got there that rape, murder, perjury, and theft were okay, only to be told when they got to the foot of Mount Sinai, bad news, none of these things is kosher after all. They're all forbidden. No, I don't think so. I think we can actually have a better explanation in every sense, superior as well as better, that no one would have been able to get as far as Mount Sinai or in any other mountain in any other direction unless they had known that human solidarity demands that we look upon each other as brothers and sisters and that we forbid activities such as murder, rape, perjury, and theft, that this is innate in us. Of those to whom it is not innate, The sociopaths who don't understand the needs of anyone but themselves and the psychopaths who positively take pleasure in breaking these rules, well, all we can say is, they, according to one theory, they're also made in the image of God, which makes the image of God question rather problematic, does it not? Or that they can be explained by further and better research and have to be restrained and disciplined meanwhile. But in no sense here is religion a help where it claims to help most, which is to our morality, to our ethics. Finally, I would say, not finally because I'm finished yet, I'm not quite done, don't relax. I hope everyone's got a drink, something to eat. But on the poison question, I think there's the real temptation of something very poisonous to human society and human relations, which is the fear of freedom, the wish to be slaves, the wish to be told what to do. Now, just as we all like to think, and we live under written documents and proclamations that encourage us to think that it is our birthright and our most precious need to be free, to be liberated, to be untrammeled, so we also know that, unfortunately, the innate in people is the servile, is the wish to be told what to do, is the adoration for strong and brutal and cruel leaders. That this other baser element of the human makeup has to be accounted for and gives us a great deal of trouble around the world as we speak. Religion, in my view, is a reification, a distillation of this wish to be a serf, to be a slave. Ask yourself if you really wish it was true that there was a celestial dictatorship that watched over you from the moment you were born, actually the moment you were conceived, all through life, night and day, knew your thoughts, waking and sleeping, could in fact convict you of thought crime. The absolute definition of a dictatorship can convict you for what you think, and what you privately want, what you're talking about to yourself, that monitors you like this under permanent surveillance, control, and supervision, and doesn't even let go of you when you're dead, because that's when the real fun begins. Now, my question is this. Who wishes that that were true? Who wants to lead the life of a serf in a celestial North Korea? I've been to North Korea. I'm one of the very few writers who has. I'm indeed the only writer who's been to all three axis of evil countries, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. And I can tell you, North Korea is the most religious state I've ever been to. I used to wonder when I was a kid, what would it be like praising God and thanking him all day and all night? Well, now I know. Because North Korea is a completely worshipful state. It's set up only to do that, for adoration. And it's only one short of a trinity. They have a father and a son, as you know, the dear leader and the great leader. The father is still the president of the country. He's been dead for 15 years. But the Kim Jong-il, the little one, is only the head of the party and the army. His father is still the president, head of the state. So you have in North Korea what you might call a necrocracy. Or what I called a morsellocracy, a thanatocracy. Just one short of a trinity. Father, son, maybe no Holy Ghost, but they do say that when the birth of the younger one took place, the birds of Korea sang in Korean to mark the occasion. This I've checked. It did not happen. Take my word for it. Didn't occur. And I suppose I should add that they don't threaten to follow you after you're dead. You can leave North Korea. You can get out of their hell and their paradise by dying. Out of the Christian and Muslim one, you cannot. Now, this is the wish to be a slave. And in my view, it poisons human relations. Now, I've already babbled for nearly 20 minutes. I'll be quick. It is argued, well, some religious people have done great things and have been motivated to do so by their faith. The most cited case in point I have found is that of Dr. Martin Luther King, who I know I don't need to explain to you about. Two quick things on that. First, he was, it's true, a minister, and he did preach the book of Exodus, the exile of an enslaved and oppressed people, as his metaphor. But if he really meant it, he would have said that the oppressed people, as the book of Exodus finds them doing, were entitled to kill anyone who stood in their way and take their land, their property, enslave their women, kill their children, and commit genocide, rape, ethnic cleansing and forcible theft of land. That's what the Book of Exodus describes happening, the full destruction of other tribes. It's very fortunate that Dr. King only meant the Bible at the most to be used as a metaphor. And after all, he was using the only book that he could be sure all of his audience had ever really read. That's the first thing. The second is, during his lifetime, he was attacked all the time for having too many secular and leftist and non-believing friends. The people like famous black secularists like Bayard Rustin, A. Philip Randolph and others, the men who actually did organize the march on Washington, which leads me to my third observation, which is this. It's a challenge I've made now in debates with rabbis, with priests of all Christian stripes, with imams. Once with a, I know this sounds like the opening of a joke about some bar, but once also with a Buddhist nun in Miami, I asked them all, here's my challenge. You have to name me an ethical statement that was made or a moral action that was performed by a religious person in the name of faith that could not have been made as an action or uttered as a statement by a person not of faith, a person of no faith. You have to do that. Not so far, I've done it at quite a high level with the religious, no takers. No one's been able to find me that. That being the case, we're entitled to say, I think, that religious faith is surplus to requirements. Whereas, if I was to ask anyone in this room, think of a wicked thing said or an evil thing done by a person of faith in the name of faith, no one would have a second of hesitation in thinking of one, would they? Interesting to realize how true that is and how much truer it's getting. Does anyone ever listen to Dennis Prager's show? He's a slightly loopy Christian broadcaster, religious broadcaster, I should say. He's not. He's more Jewish than Christian, Judeo-Christian broadcaster, who quite often rather generously has me on his show. And he asked me a question the other day. He had a challenge of his own. He said, you're to imagine that you're in a town late at night where you've never been before and you have no friends and it's getting dark. And through the darkness, you see coming towards you a group of men, let's say 10. Do you feel better or worse if you know that they're just coming from a prayer meeting? This is Mr. Prager's question to me. I say, well, Mr. Prager, without leaving you, without quitting the letter B, I can tell you I've had that experience in Belfast, in Beirut, in Baghdad, in Bombay, in Bosnia, and in Bethlehem. And if you see anyone coming from a religious gathering in any of those places, you know exactly how fast you need to run. And no one has to explain to you why. And I haven't had to waste any time telling you, have I, ladies and gentlemen? So I submit to you that it is those who are people of faith who have the explaining to do, who have the justifying to do with, if this is indeed the case. If they can't account for anything about the origin of our cosmos or our species, if they say that without them, we'd be without morals and make us seem as if we are merely animals without faith. If further, everybody can name an instance where religion has made people actually behave worse to one another and act as a retardant upon the advances of knowledge and science and information, I submit that the case to be made is theirs rather than mine. And we have a better tradition. We're not just arid secularists and materialists. We're on the atheist side. We can point through the Hubble telescope, the fantastic, awe-inspiring, majestic pictures that are being taken now of the outer limits of our universe. And who's going to turn away from those pictures and start gaping again at the burning bush? We have smaller microscopes that can examine for us the miracles of the interior and the double helix and the sheer beauty of that. The natural world is wonderful enough, more wonderful than anything conjured by the fools who believe in astrology or the supernatural. And we have a better tradition politically. Against the popes and the imams and the witch doctors and the divine right of kings and the whole long tradition of civic repression combined with the religion that's known as theocracy, we have created in the United States the only country in the history of the world written on founding documents testable, organized works in progress based on the theory of human liberation, and the only constitution in the history of the world that says that there shall be a separation between the church and the state. God is never mentioned in the United States Constitution except in order to limit religion and keep it out of politics and put it under legal control. This achievement was described by President Jefferson, whose biographer I am in a small way, to the Baptists of Danbury, Connecticut, in a letter after they'd written to him for fear of persecution. By the way, who do you think Baptists of Danbury, Connecticut were afraid of being persecuted by? Anyone knows? No. No, the Congregationalists of Danbury, Connecticut. People forget what it used to be like. See how the Christians loved each other, how they tried to repeat the European pattern of one religious sect repressing and torturing another one. And as you probably know, the president wrote back and said, no, you may be assured that there will ever be in this country a wall of separation between the church and the state. So I have a new slogan, and I'm taking it on tour, and I invite you to join me in it. And it goes like this: Mr. Jefferson, build up that wall. I mean, North Korea is a hermetic place, unfortunately, in that it has ocean on either side of it, the demilitarized zone, which is several miles wide on the south, and Russia and China on the north. So you have a place where you can horribly conduct an experiment on human beings, essentially. You can isolate them totally. The North Korean state was set up in the same year that Orwell published 1984. And you almost think that somebody gave Kim Il-sung a copy of 1984 in Korean and said, do you think we could make this fly? And he said, well, I can't be sure, but we sure can give it the old college try. Because that's how it feels there. I went there, I thought, I've had this experience, I'll just digress for a second. I've had this experience twice in my life. Journalists hate cliché. I know it doesn't always seem like that when you read the papers, but we try and avoid them. I went to Prague once under the old days of the communist regime. I thought, whatever happens to me here, I'm not going to mention Franz Kafka in my essay. I'm going to be the first journalist not to do it. I went to a meeting of the opposition underground. Somebody betrayed us, because the secret police came in suddenly, wham, like this, broke down the door, dogs, torches, rubber truncheons, the lot, slammed me against the wall. You're under arrest. I demand to see the British ambassador, blah, blah. You're under arrest. What's the charge? We don't have to tell you that. I thought, fuck, I've got to mention Kafka after all. They make you do it. Well, I that's actually what a cliche is. That's, communism is a cliche in itself. Same in North Korea. I thought, I don't want to mention Orwell. I don't want to mention Orwell. Now I have to mention him. There's no other standard of comparison. No, what I meant about the fear of freedom was this. Many, many people don't, of course, want to live under a hellish starvation regime of gulag type like that. But they quite like being told what to do. And they don't want to be told that life doesn't, world doesn't owe them a living, and that they're on their own, and they quite like it, and repeatedly vote for parties and sometimes leaders who promise to provide everything as long as they'll give up just a little bit of freedom. Just a little bit. And the trade-off, you'll get more security, more welfare. It's a temptation. In some cases, it takes an extreme form. And I'm very impressed by how often when I debate with religious people, they will tell me that they gravitate towards faith because they want someone to, if you like, look after them. The whole idea of a heavenly father, for example, is built up in this. There's the old joke says, some say God is dead, some say God is dad. You figure. Then there are people who, well, Islam, for example, the word Islam means surrender, prostration. You give everything to God. You everything's in his hands. This is implicitly totalitarian. That's all I mean. But I think it's innate in most people, is the feeling that they'd quite like someone to take care of them all the time. So it can be hard to argue with them that there is no such person. And that one day there will be a North Korean edition of 1984, and it'll be a huge bestseller there. I'm as sure of that as I can be of anything. Though, at the moment, it's hard to imagine that there's anyone in North Korea who's even allowed to consider the concept of political liberty. It will come, because it is innate. I've no doubt about that.
Еще вечер, мама, блясфемичная. Не mi spanec kratite, zvonov mi ozvočje dušite.
Zvok, ki prebije zid.